From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was roundly condemned last year when he unveiled the Pentagon's new Office of Strategic Influence to feed disinformation to the foreign media. He claimed it was all a misunderstanding and supposedly scrapped the idea. But recently, in the LA Times, military analyst and critic Bill Arkin explained that the Office of Strategic Influence is not dead, but thriving under different names throughout the Pentagon. Arkin has obtained dozens of Pentagon documents that describe in detail how the military has restructured itself top to bottom to fight a global information war that could blow back into the United States.
What you have is stories that are coming out or being manufactured supposedly for the consumption of the Islamic publics, stories that, say, for instance, might originate in Egypt or Jordan or Algeria. Some of the countries that are, it is clear that the United States has bought off the intelligence services of, and those stories will make their way back into the U.S. It's those kinds of stories where they don't go through the same kind of rigorous checks and balances and editing and double checking and double sourcing that you might have in the American media, where all of a sudden things that aren't fact become fact because they get picked up in the international media and ultimately find their way back into the American public's mind.
Can you give me some specific examples of how these doctrines will manipulate the American news media?
I guess on some level, all I can do is point to the organizations because we don't know yet what they are actually doing or how it has had influence. What we do know is that a Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Special Plans has been created. What we do know is that there is a special cell that has been established within that office that is responsible for deception. What we do know is that information warfare has been elevated to a mission of the U.S. Strategic Command. What we do know is that the Air Force has transferred all of its bombers and fighters out of the 8th Air Force and made it solely an information operations air force. What we do know is that the Navy has created a Naval Network Warfare Command. What we do know is that there are new doctrines and policies which have been created by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, by the Secretary of Defense, and by the individual services which trumpet deception, perception management, strategic influence operations, better control of the news media, and those doctrines and policies, all of which have been established, signed, and issued in 2001 and 2002, seem to indicate that there is a kind of blurring of the distinction between public information and psychological warfare.
Of all the new policies, programs, and positions that you described in your LA Times piece, I think the one that was the most lurid, although deliciously so, is the new Air Force policy that describes information warfare's goals as destruction, degradation, denial, disruption, deceit, and exploitation. And this may be my favorite military acronym, which boils down to D5E.
It's there, Brooke. On paper, the Air Force's new strategy of information warfare includes all of these Ds. And somehow we are supposed to believe that the military, first of all, can get its act together to practice this form of warfare without tripping all over their information. And then second of all, that somehow this is going to be practiced against Iraq or against Taliban or against North Korea or Iran, and that it's not going to blow back into the United States.
But we don't have any proof that it will blow back, as you say. We don't know even what has come into operation yet. We simply know the Pentagon boilerplate that has fallen into your hands in the form of government documents.
You know, I don't know whether or not it's blown back either, Brooke. But I have to say to you that if one looks at the causes of September 11th and thinks about the war on terrorism as this permanent Cold War, as Secretary Rumsfeld describes it, this war that will be going on in more or less perpetuity, it disturbs me as an American to think that I am subject to possible disinformation and deception perpetrated by the American government in fighting that war. And so I don't think we have a good example yet of where this has all come together. My guess is that in some ways it hasn't. Pretty much so it is the case in my 20-plus years of watching the U.S. military, that it is when the doctrines and the policies are first written that it takes quite some time to pull all the pieces together and to build the competent people that are required. But the bottom line here is that we see every day, despite the fact that the Bush administration is superb at controlling information, that it has had one of the strongest anti-leak policies in modern times, that it has been ferocious about government secrecy, that there are constant controlled leaks that come out about the Iraqi war plan. Now, if those are indeed controlled leaks, and their intent is to influence the Iraqis into cooperating with the United Nations or to deter or scare the Iraqis about upcoming military operations, that's one thing. But if at the same time the American public has the perception that it is more important to go to war against Iraq than it might otherwise be, or that that war will be easier than it will be, then it seems to me that we're manipulating public opinion about going to war in Iraq inadvertently as part of the policy of deceiving and psyching out Saddam Hussein.
Well, Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Longtime military observer and analyst Bill Arkin writes a regular column for the LA Times and serves as a military analyst for NBC News.
Democratic Federal Communications Commissioner Michael Copps sits on a Republican-dominated panel steering the nation toward ever greater media concentration and ever less programming diversity. Frustrated by the deregulatory bent of FCC Chairman Michael Powell, Commissioner Copps is fighting back by scheduling public hearings to generate opposition to a further loosening of ownership restrictions. He joins me now. Commissioner, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
You've said that the upcoming votes by the FCC have some, quote, profound democratic and social and political considerations that we ignore only at our own tremendous peril. What specifically are you referring to?
Well, I think, not to be too dramatic about it, that a specter is haunting our communications landscape, and that specter is the threat to remove the protections that we currently have against excessive media consolidation. How many stations one company can own, how much of an audience a company can reach, can you own the newspaper and the broadcast stations and the cable station in a specific area. Up for decision now, this coming spring, is whether to eliminate all of those protections.
I can tell you from grim experience that already a certain percentage of our audience has had its eyes glaze over at the very invocation of the term media concentration. And what I'd like you to do now, please, explain to me in fairly concrete terms why it is not in the public interest for one corporation to own large numbers of broadcast stations, particularly in a market where they own a newspaper. What difference does it make to me, the consumer?
Let's start off just talking about entertainment and the kind of programming and music that you're hearing. You know, I think the American people are used to creativity and local music and regional music just springing up locally and regionally. And if it has something to it, then it goes national. I think now we're kind of in a reverse situation where we have all of these consolidated stations that are owned and operated by such a small number of companies and directed by the frenzy for advertising or revenue. And what you have is kind of a homogenized diet that's being fed to the American people. So there has been a tremendous change already. The question now is whether we want to visit that on the rest of the media landscape.
Commissioner Michael Powell, the chairman of the FCC, has demonstrated, at a minimum, a laissez-faire attitude towards increased consolidation. I'm curious, what did he say to you when he discovered that you had scheduled hearings on this subject?
Well, let me say, first of all, I have given up on none of my fellow commissioners or the chairman. I think there's a feeling amongst some at the commission that if you do a few econometric studies and a few professional studies, that you can proceed and base your decision on that, and that going out into specific media markets does not add a lot to the public record. I disagree vehemently with that. And, you know, the media really have a tremendous responsibility to help us tee up this dialogue for American consumers. And you have to understand at the outset that some of them may be financially impacted by the outcome of our votes.
In fact, they are the media consolidators themselves in most cases, are they not?
Right. And I have a lot of representatives of large companies that come to my office to assure me about the independence of their newsroom and their news gathering operation from their advertising or their corporate boardroom.
There seems to be very little coverage on about the media consolidation issue on NBC, owned by General Electric, on CBS, owned by Viacom, on ABC, owned by Walt Disney, on the Fox News Channel. Is it because the subject does make viewers' eyes glaze over, or do you believe that the conflict of interest has actually tainted the news departments and kept them from covering this issue?
I would rather say that I'm going to do everything I possibly can to encourage them, to go around and talk to them, to cover this story. And if I don't see it covered, I might be in a little better position to answer that question. But if that separation is there and is valid, then I think we'll see their news folks going out and covering the issue. And I think when the American people begin to express their concern on it, they'll have to cover the issue.
Well, what you've said about outreach and about building a record is all well and good. But I got to ask you again, as a practical matter, is there any chance in the world that Michael Powell will have some sort of life-altering experience between now and the time the vote comes in that will change the FCC's position on media consolidation?
I don't know what conversion he may or may not go through, but I know that he doesn't cast the only vote. We have five commissioners now as of last week. We are finally up to full complement. And I am hoping when I go out and have these hearings that I will have other commissioners and may even have a majority of commissioners attending some of them if I can make them happen and bring that to pass.
Michael Copps, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Michael Copps is a Democratic member of the Federal Communications Commission.
Coming up, the problem with business reporting, new barriers, and a few breakthroughs.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Beginning last summer, rules promulgated by the stock exchanges and approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission required broadcasters airing the opinion of securities analysts to disclose any business interests the analyst or his firm might have in the stocks being discussed. Now the SEC is poised to approve a similar New York Stock Exchange rule for the print media, and the print media are going predictably ballistic. If they do not print the disclosures according to the stock exchange template, they will be denied access to sources they now routinely cover. Adam Leshinsky, a columnist for Fortune magazine, believes that the rule acts as a gag order limiting freedom of the press. Still, he says, the abuses committed not that long ago suggest that some action was called for.
throughout the boom, you know, from the mid-90s onward, analysts, fund managers, people involved with companies would go on television, particularly on CNBC, and they would be talking as if they were giving advice, when in fact what they were doing is what's known as talking their book. They were talking up their own investments or their own investment banking relationships.
But now the rule is being extended to print publications. In effect, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ are demanding that papers who quote analysts print the very same potential conflict of interest material within their articles that the broadcasters are required to put in supers on their screens. In effect, they're dictating content to newspapers. And if the newspapers don't accept the terms, what happens? They're frozen out?
Well, not only are they dictating what the newspapers must write and what the broadcasters must say, but they're telling their members, the analysts who are New York Stock Exchange members, that if that newspaper doesn't print your disclosure, you may not talk to them in the future. So think about the implications there. They're saying that you may not get information out to the public, at least not through the avenue of the reporter who refused to print your conflict.
Now, there's all sorts of problems that can flow from that, obviously, not the least of which is it will result in a net reduction of the amount of information going to investors. But it's also a clear infringement on the freedom of the press, but it's not a government infringement. There's no constitutional amendment guaranteeing press access to private companies. So is there anything that the print press can do about this?
There is a constitutional problem because it's telling the press what they must write. And there's no precedent for that, certainly not in the newspapers. And this isn't political speech. This is commercial speech. So is there anything that the newspapers can do? Sure, they can certainly oppose this on constitutional grounds and will.
As I understand it, this rule has to be signed off on by the Securities and Exchange Commission. If that's the case, then there is a governmental aspect to this, and a government agency would be, in fact, endorsing an arrangement that infringes on free speech. I gather that the best First Amendment case resides there.
Oh, absolutely. And just think about what's being done here. The SEC's job is to protect investors and regulate the securities industry. They're not supposed to have any purview over the media, certainly not over newspapers. And that's where they're going to have to be reined back. And I suspect they will be. The whole thing doesn't smell right. And I think they'll agree with that.
So what would your suggestion be? On the one hand, it's in the interest of investors to get information that they can trust, or at least to have all of the potential conflicts on the table. On the other hand, newspapers are not accustomed to being told what to do, much less being extorted to run information, which appears to be the case here. Is there a solution that doesn't involve such an extraordinary degree of coercion?
Well, in fact, Bob, we have a solution. What's needed is a code of conduct on the part of the media, and in a truly capitalist way, we effectively have one now, which is that we, the media, have been embarrassed by our behavior over the past, let's say, 5 years, and so we've developed, if not a formal code of conduct, an informal code of conduct. Realize newspapers are doing what they're being asked to. If an analyst tells a business reporter, I own this stock, or my investment bank led their IPO 2 years ago, it's highly likely that the writer will write that in his or her article. So what's at issue here, as you put it, is our desire to not be coerced. The New York Stock Exchange has every reason to be in the business of telling its members how to do their jobs, but not the other way around.
Well, Adam Leshinsky, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Bob.
Adam Leshinsky is a senior writer for Fortune magazine based in Palo Alto, California.
As part of his economic team shakeup this week, President Bush recruited three more corporate chieftains into his administration. The appointments of radio executive John Snow as Treasury Secretary, former Goldman Sachs head Stephen Friedman as Chief White House Economic Advisor, and ex-investment banker Ronald Donaldson as Security and Exchange Commission Chairman are just more evidence of how business and politics increasingly intertwine. And yet this is a phenomenon that the press has been behind the curve in covering, as OTM's John Solomon explains.
With former businessman George W. Bush now at the top of the government's organizational chart, more and more it seems that the business of politics is business, and the business of business is politics. News organizations are generally structured to cover the public and private sector separately. That may be why they were late to recognize how the two overlapped in the recent corporate scandals. Harvard Business School professor Quinn Mills is the author of the book Buy, Lie, and Sell High.
The business journalist didn't get the whole story. The Washington political journalist didn't see the whole story, and it fell between the cracks.
For a reporter, getting the whole story would have required knowing the arcana of both Capitol Hill and Wall Street.
Well, Washington and New York might as well be two completely different countries.
Laura Unger was a commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission from 1997 through 2000 and served as acting chairman in 2001. She is now the on-air regulatory analyst for CNBC.
If you have someone who's only grown up in either one environment or the other, it's very hard to have the dual perspective that you need to give the full and complete picture of both of those worlds.
Wall Street Journal reporter Greg Ipp covered the financial markets for 4 years before moving to the Washington Bureau in early 2001. He says that business government stories ring different media bells.
I think throughout the late 90s, there was no secret whatsoever that Wall Street investment banks were seriously conflicted when it came to doing analyst research. We at the Journal and other organizations wrote many, many articles about this, but it didn't really sort of like seize the political class's interest here in Washington until it took place against the backdrop of a recession and a bear market and scandal.
While addressing the propriety of those conflicts is a responsibility of legislators and regulators, the press was not very aggressive in asking them why so little action was taken. Alan Murray is the co-anchor of CNBC's Capital Report, a year-old primetime show that attempts to bridge the journalistic gap between business and government. He says journalism's structural difficulty handling these kinds of stories has historical roots.
It was only, 25 years ago that the New York Times adopted its business section. And before that time, business reporters were sort of the guy with a drinking problem that you pushed over onto the financial desk to write favorable stories about the local businesses. Journalism and politics seem to be kind of the same thing, and business and economics seem to be something very different. And so I think that whole realm of journalism has been slow to develop, and then it developed as somehow separate from politics. And I think it took the events of the last year, September 11th, Enron, to really drive home to people that you can't separate these two things.
Adding to the repertorial challenge is that these stories often go beyond just politics and finance and into the complexities of other industries, such as energy, says Time Magazine's Karen Tumulty.
But you do see, for instance, in California, that the kind of manipulation that was going on in the market was something that probably could have used a lot more digging and a lot more explanation. And instead, I think all of us in the media kind of defaulted to the politicians, to the war of words and the, you know, political machinations that were going on. And it really took probably a year before we actually saw, you know, why it was that people were running out of energy in California.
Tumulty says that the media's coverage of the corporate governance issue has improved a lot over the past year. But Greg Ipp warns that good economic news could undo some of the progress.
I think going forward there's going to be a lot more emphasis at news organizations put into trying to understand better accounting and financial and business issues. But that said, once the economy pulls out of the recession, and presumably it will, and once the stock market stops going down, as presumably it will, people's attention will shift to other things again.
Ipp says rotating reporters is one way to maintain that broad focus, but it will also help to have management move around as well.
I would say it's probably more important that our bosses, that is to say our editors and our bureau chiefs, spend some time rotating through bureaus and covering the different worlds, because it's ultimately their responsibility to look at all the stories that we as an organization are covering and to see how they intersect and to come up to the reporter that's covering, for example, Enron as a company and say, hey, maybe there's an issue here with respect to energy regulatory policy or with respect to its political connections to the president or the Congress.
Charles Whelan, who teaches at the Medill School of Journalism and is the author of a new book, Naked Economics, says that newsrooms might take a tip from the business world to accelerate their team reporting efforts.
My guess is that you've got to assemble a group of folks who are expert on all the little pieces, just as you might do if you were running a really complex corporation or something like that, and start pooling information more than you do now. That's certainly not the normal practice for journalism. It's not traditionally been organized where there's an awful lot of sharing across areas, but my guess is that's something that's probably going to have to change.
Change doesn't have to be hard. It can be as simple as tapping out a quick email. When President Bush came into office, many political reporters accepted the conventional wisdom in Washington that he managed just like a corporate CEO. That's because he worked shorter hours, insisted on a dress code, and didn't sweat policy details. But they could have found out that those habits had little resemblance to the managerial style of most modern chief executives, by either checking with their business section colleagues or even the CEOs of their own companies. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
This month, Anchor Books released an anthology that may well be the first of its kind, called Best Business Crime Writing of the Year. And oh, what a year it was! Enron, ImClone, WorldCom, Adelphi, Tyco, Quest, and of course, Arthur Anderson. The villains of these tales were as colorful as their misdeeds. There was WorldCom's church-going CEO Bernie Ebbers and Salomon Smith Barney's Jack Grubman, the wheeler-dealer telecom analyst who was caught touting stocks on television that he knew to be losers. On this program, we discussed how and why much of the business press failed to report on the disasters in progress, but there has been a great deal of gripping and clarifying coverage after the fact, according to James Surowiecki, business columnist for The New Yorker and editor of Best Business Crime Writing of the Year. He joins me now. James, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, it seemed that the stories, at least in the early part of the 90s, were about profit and innovation, and they were replaced very suddenly by stories of fraud and loss.
It certainly is the case that in the last year, the shift has been pretty immense, both in terms of, obviously, as you said, the literal kind of stories that are written, but also the tone. I think it's fair to say that in the late 90s, there was a somewhat of a cheerleading tone. The great example of that would be the deification of CEOs as these sort of superhuman beings. And I think in the last year, you saw more of a return to a more skeptical and in some ways cynical understanding of what was actually going on.
Listen, I'm going to ask you to do something really hard here. I'm going to toss you your book.
Okay.
Pick out your favorite paragraph.
Of anybody's?
Yeah.
All right. Let me see if I can. Okay. This, I don't know if this is my favorite, but this is a good paragraph.
And who wrote this one?
Stephen Rosenbusch was the byline, and then there were five other Business Week reporters who worked with.
And when was it?
August of 2002. This was a piece called Inside the Telecom Game, and it was a piece that basically drew a picture of Jack Grubman's relationship with all of these different CEOs who were running these different telecom companies.
Grubman is the Citicorp analyst who got his kids into preschool through some shady dealings.
Exactly. Can I go ahead?
Yeah.
Grubman's formula for his success was to grow increasingly close to the managers at the telecom companies he was covering. He recruited execs, helped plot strategy, and advised on mergers. For example, he helped Bernie Ebbers launch WorldCom's hostile bid for MCI in 1998, which resulted in a $43 billion acquisition. Rival analysts chafed at Grubman's chumminess with the execs he was covering. He'd get on a company's conference call and just start talking about what he thought about the company, says one analyst. We all had questions for the company, and he was asking them, so how about that dinner last night, huh?
It does tell you a lot. I noticed that you pulled articles from all kinds of sources, newspapers, weeklies, and monthly magazines, even online publications. Was there anything in particular you found interesting?
Well, I was hoping that local newspapers would be great sources that would be included in here because, you know, they would be close to the companies. And there are a couple examples of that. There's a great Rocky Mountain News piece about Quest. And then there's this great profile of Bernie Ebbers that ran in the Edmonton Sun because he's from Edmonton, which I had not known until I read this thing. But it is interesting because in other cases, it was very clear that the local paper had in some way cast its lot with the company. So, for example, the Jackson Ledger or Clarion Ledger, whatever it's called, in Mississippi, there was nothing really substantive about what WorldCom was doing because it was just they sort of bought the Bernie Ebbers line in a way.
And after the truth about Enron came to light, many people, as we said, criticized the business media for not catching the misdeed sooner. And you were saying, actually, in your intro, you were talking about independent knowers. These are institutions whose business it is, and I'm quoting from you, to distinguish between the trustworthy and the trustworthless. And you talk about accountants and the Better Business Bureau. Can the business media actually function as independent knowers?
You know, someone like Gretchen Morgenson at the New York Times, I think, and actually Floyd Norris there, there are writers who have clearly sort of staked out an independent position. But it's difficult. I mean, because in a strange way, the more access you get, the harder it is to write these kinds of pieces.
Almost, why?
I think. Well, because I think then it becomes a question of loyalty. And in a sense, getting access becomes really essential to the story. Take the old example of, you know, the Wall Street Journal, which became so powerful that essentially companies would leak news of mergers to them in advance, but in exchange, the journal would agree not to print the news. And I mean, there you have this very complicated relationship.
Well, I don't think it's complicated. It's
just
plain unethical.
It is. No, you're right. It is unethical. You're right. It is. But it's sort of a function in a weird way of the journal's importance. Probably if you looked at it, the role of the business media in relation to what it's covering is not historically as adversarial as other areas, and maybe not expected to be by the people who are reading their things. In some ways, probably business is probably closer, has been closer historically to like sports journalism than political journalism.
And you think it still will be after
all? I think
this?
It's going to be better. I think there's no question it's going to be better. It's easier to sell stories on accounting than it was, and that I think will help. Some people have made reputations and made names for themselves by digging under this stuff. That will help. I mean, someone like Chris Byron, for example, at the New York Post, you know, that's basically his job is to search this stuff out. But I mean, the other thing one would hope is that there are going to be fewer of these stories to be done. I mean, you know, ideally you're not going to have this book next year. This should be a one-off basically, but you know, who knows?
James Surowiecki is a financial columnist for The New Yorker and editor of Best Business Crime Writing of the Year.
And now an update. This spring, we started following a story that began when the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague subpoenaed former Washington Post reporter Jonathan Randall to testify against a Bosnian Serb he had once quoted in a story. In July, the Washington Post announced that it would appeal the decision, Randall in the Post arguing that testifying endangers journalists' lives and press freedoms, and that reporters should not have to give testimony unless they have exclusive information that could determine guilt or innocence. This week, the Post and Randall won that landmark battle. He will not be forced to testify in The Hague. Journalists and their sources can happily put this story to bed.
Coming up, no news is bad news on BET, a hip-hop dust-up in Manhattan, and the rise and fall of the instrumental.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Here's a clip from a story this week on the Black Entertainment Television Public Affairs Program, BET Tonight.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Ed Gordon. We've all heard the stories. The multi-platinum selling singer who files for bankruptcy, a group who sues its label to get paid or out of a contract. Artist rights, what record labels require from...
There won't be many clips like that on BET because the show won't be around for a new season. BET Tonight, along with the Sunday Issue Forum Lead Story and the youth-oriented Teen Summit, have been canceled. 2 years after BET's sale by founder and CEO Bob Johnson to Viacom. When Viacom acquired BET, critics feared for the channel's community service mission. Among them, Michael Eric Dyson, the Avalon Professor of the Humanities at the University of Pennsylvania. He joins me now. Professor, welcome to OTM.
Well, thank you for having me.
So has the other shoe dropped at BET? Is this what everyone was expecting and fearing?
I'm afraid so. I think that everyone was fearful that sooner or later, and now it's sooner rather than later, the mission to inform African-American people from a broad-based news network perspective would be somehow relegated to the periphery. And what would come front and center is what was itching up there anyway, a bunch of entertainment that was not geared toward the intellectual or creative stimulation of its audience.
All right, now let's be fair here. Bob Johnson is many things. A missionary of social activism is not one of them. And
sure.
Even under, and of course he still manages BET, but under his sole ownership, he always made the point that Black Entertainment Television Network was a business largely for and about blacks, but it wasn't a black business in the sense that issues black would be put before issues of profit and audience. Is Viacom any different?
Perhaps not. And I think that, yes, we don't want to be disingenuous. The man is there to make money. And as the people would say in the street, we ain't mad at him. Make your money. But you can make money and make meaning at the same time. You can do well and do good. And I think that the problem here is that you can't be exempt from critique. Even if you weren't a so-called black company, if you were, you know, if you were saying, look, I'm about business first, that's fine. Then let's talk about the business of news. Let's talk about the business of serving that constituency. Network televisions, they provide a outlet for public service. We can't exempt Mr. Johnson or his company or Viacom, now having bought it, from the same critical inquiry that we would launch against him were he not owned by this large behemoth.
Let's take a hard look at one of the business problems. Older people watch the news. Younger people watch videos.
Right.
Unfortunately, advertisers aren't interested very much in older viewers. They only want those young eyeballs. In this case, BET was saddled with the same demographic problem that CBS and CNN and everybody else is faced with. You say they just have to respond to it differently.
Well, look, it's not as if there is a lack of exposure to that vaunted, ostensibly important demographic, the 18 to 35 or what some such they're looking for. The reality is that you got enough TNA and behind shaking going on BET to glut the network. The reality is that most of the program is geared toward them. 106, you know, Street and Rap City, the marketers can have a field day. What we're talking about is a hour show maybe on Saturday for Teen Summit once a week. Lead story is once a week on Sunday, perhaps a replay later on, and every night with Ed Gordon for half an hour. So you're not speaking of an enormous time commitment on the part of BET or Viacom, its parent owners.
Okay, but you're talking about loss leaders, and you know, they just buried Rune Arledge, and since he got into the TV business in about 1982, news divisions haven't been run anywhere as loss leaders. They've been run as profit centers.
But look, if they're in that deep at the hock, that they need those 3 hours to salvage the station, then they're in deep trouble, brother, and that won't help them.
Now, BET is not abandoning news altogether. It will continue with its nightly news and with documentaries and specials. Not good enough for you?
No, not at all. Well, you know, Jackie Reed does an extraordinarily good job on BET, a half-hour news show per night. But of course not. A particular issue like Trent Lott, they're not going to take more than a couple minutes on a BET news program to address that, but they could address it at length on Lead Story. They could invite Mr. Lott or invite people who are involved in the Congress to come and air their views. That is now evaporated. That cannot be done suitably on a half-hour news program. We won't see the wide swath of perspective and ideology that regularly shows up on BET. It's an entirely different perspective than the kind of narrow framework into which you're pigeonholed on network or even some other cable outlets.
Michael Eric Dyson, thank you very much.
Thank you very kindly.
Professor Michael Eric Dyson is a professor of humanities at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of, among other things, Holler If You Hear Me, Searching for Tupac Shakur.
Once upon a time in New York City, WQHT, known as Hot 97, was all that in hip-hop radio. The station had the hip-hop market all to itself. But now, Hot 97 is duking it out with another top 10 station for dominance in a market worth millions in advertising revenues. OTM's Allison Keyes reports.
Yo, what's up, New York? This your boy Jaheim Jersey. And I'm hanging out with my dog, Star, on Hot 97. One love, still ghetto, baby.
Until March, MS Broadcasting's Hot 97 was the only game in town for hip-hop fans. Then Clear Channel, the gargantuan radio conglomerate, decided to muscle into the market. It switched its oldie station, 105.1, to hip-hop and changed its name to Power 105.1. Almost immediately, Power 105.1 nearly tied Hot 97 in the ratings and confused a number of fans.
All right, right on there. Just tell me what station you made the switch to.
105.1, baby.
Whoa. There's something that goes before the 105.1.
Hot? What?
No. Now you know.
That's why you should have voted for Clara, because Clara knows.
Now you can't handle tickets.
Told you should have voted for Clara.
Forget about it.
David Hinckley, who covers radio and television for the New York Daily News, says the competition between the stations has made listening to the radio fun again, especially at a time when too many stations deliver focus group-based programming anchored by what he says sounds like robots.
When you've got this kind of conflict between two radio stations, or saying, I'm better, no, I'm better, you're worse, no, you're worse, as long as it isn't carried to really silly levels, which so far it hasn't been, it's just a lot of fun to listen to because it feels like, you know, human drama that's kind of unfolding day by day for you.
Hinckley says back in 1993, when Hot 97 first went hip-hop, people thought it was a huge mistake. No one would listen to this music, and any station who played it certainly wasn't going to make any money. Wrong. Last year, Hot 97 grossed $39.7 million in revenue. The same year, 105.1, then known as WTJM, grossed just $16.4 million in advertising. Clear Channel assumed it would do better with hip-hop. There aren't any hard numbers yet, but the station's programming bulges with ads for everything from cell phones to luxury cars.
Gradually, I think the advertising community has realized what should have been obvious all along, which is that the hip-hop audience is not, in fact, just kids who wear their hats backwards on the streets. It's a group of people who cover the same range as the whole population. You've got business executives, you've got students, you've got very responsible people who just like this music. Love you.
Fans of both stations also love the way the DJs keep them up on the latest celebrity news.
We haven't talked about Bobby Brown in 48 hours. Because he ain't did nothing.
What could Bobby be up to right now?
He's just waking up.
We're on a Bobby Brown.
And hip-hop reviews.
Hey, I didn't give Jay-Z's CD a rating from 1 to 10.
Oh, yeah, you got to do that.
I'll give it a 6.
The drama often heard on the airwaves actually spilled into the streets this fall. Hot 97 DJ Funkmaster Flex, whose real name is Aston Taylor, was arrested. He was charged with assaulting Stephanie Saunders, known as Big Steph Lover, who left Hot 97 for Power 105.1. As the story goes, the whole dispute stemmed from a June interview Lover did with rapper Nas after Nas stormed out of a Hot 97 concert. Matt Conaway, who writes for HipHopSite.com and Vibe magazine, runs it all down.
He ran to 105, their main competitor, and basically just went on like a 2 or 3 hour verbal rampage of how Hot 97 was ruining hip-hop and, you know, how Funkmaster Flex was already suspected of making people pay to get airplay and things like that.
Flex has denied accepting money to play certain discs. Neither station returned calls. Power 105.1 also raised Hot 97's hackles by hiring away veteran hip-hop personalities Dr. Dre and Ed Lover. Fans at a Harlem record store, Jasmine, Vanessa, and Casey, are fascinated by the theatrics and aren't afraid to take sides.
And I like 105.1 because I like Ed Lover and Dr. Dre. You I like Ed Lover and Dr. Dre because I like the roll call in the morning and the booty call thing in the morning. I listen before I go to school.
I like Hot 97 because they put in like 50 Cent. They be having hot stuff in there. The other one just be having like slow songs, like, you know.
I think it's pretty good, you know. It's good for the people to have more than one station to listen to.
And it's a choice that has netted the two competitors an incredible 10% of the radio audience in New York City. For On the Media, I'm Allison Keyes.
Hip-hop depends on words as much as rhythm for its impact, but there was a time when no words were required to make a hit. On the Media's Rex Stone offers a look back at the rock instrumental.
Mad Daddy Giggle Jiggles, never chicken. Yeah, Archie Bleyer will give you sound to tumble. All the cats really flip over this crazy, wavy rumble.
Among the many changes Top 40 Radio has endured over the past four decades, it is the disappearance of rock instrumentals that rates as one of the more painful losses for pop purists. Records like Rumble, as presented here by Cleveland DJ Pete Mad Daddy Myers back in 1958, used to be heard liberally alongside vocal hits. For Stephen Otfanowski, author of The Golden Age of Instrumentals, Top 40 Radio of the 50s and 60s was an embarrassment of riches.
The democracy of music at that point was just incredible. AM radio had everything from pop to jazz to R&B to rock and roll, country and western. Oh, everything was in the top 40 of that period, and instrumentals was part of that mix.
Top 40 radio stations not only featured a broad spectrum of music, but the instrumental hits they played ran the gamut of styles as well.
And we call it rock instrumentals, but it really was many, many different kinds of music that fed into rock and roll and R&B, or part of that format at the time.
Surf tunes, along with country, soul, R&B, and even easy listening songs, were all part of the instrumental rock phenomena. And then there were those instrumental chart toppers that defied description.
There were strange gimmicks with sound effects. There was a thing called a green mosquito, where you had a mosquito buzzing around. You had rocking crickets, where you had the sound of crickets in between the musical passages. You had all sorts of crazy things, and these songs today might never make the charts, but back then, that kind of novelty in instrumental caught people's ears and sold records.
Instrumental records, even Rockin' Cricket, were being purchased and played in appreciable numbers. As Otfanowski points out, there was no shortage of instrumental hits when guitar licks and saxophone riffs ruled the airwaves.
As I state in my book, there were at least 250 charting songs in the top 40 that were instrumentals between, say, 1956, when really the genre took off with a song called Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett and his combo, until about 1966, which is when the last great instrumental burst came through with Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, which was kind of the last word in instrumentals.
The pseudo-mariachi sounds of Alpert made several forays into the pop charts. Alpert, along with Duane Eddy, Link Wray, and groups like The Ventures and Booker T and the MGs, all enjoyed fruitful and sustained careers as instrumental-only artists. And while their careers began to wane in the late 60s, a new brand of instrumental was being heard on the radio.
Yeah, during the 70s and early 80s, it certainly still had some currency because of TV themes, because of the Rockford Files, because of the theme from SWAT.
Sean Ross is the group editor at Billboard Airplay Monitor.
Eventually, of course, the whole TV and movie soundtrack business changed, and even there, the focus went away from instrumentals.
Instrumental hits that didn't have the benefit of being tied to a hit television show were becoming rarer still. While the hit Popcorn, for better or worse, peaked at number 9 in 1972, it was the disco craze that temporarily spared the instrumental. While hits like The True Sounds of Philadelphia saw plenty of chart action, by the time the 80s rolled around, radio gave a firm veto to nearly any song without a vocal. Monica Lynch, former president of Tommy Boy Records, provides perspective on the plight of the all-instrumental act.
In today's landscape, image is paramount, and it's very difficult for the most part in today's industry, which is so high stakes and where there's so much money involved. They want to know that when a single comes out by an artist, that the public and the radio stations and the video outlets will immediately grasp the image, the concept, the performer. And that may be a much more difficult thing to do if it's an instrumental with no vocal or lyrical hook.
The emphasis major labels began to place on music videos as a primary means of marketing also helped place the instrumental on the endangered species list.
You know, in the past 20 years, the visualization of music has just intensified, certainly since the birth of MTV. And that has effectively pushed out a lot of niches of the pop spectrum.
The reluctance of the record industry to push instrumentals is equaled only by the reluctance of commercial radio to play them.
Radio has changed so dramatically since the last time instrumentals had any play on radio that the barriers may be too difficult to get around or to get over.
Eric Bollert writes for Salon.com.
Yeah, I mean, if radio does play an instrumental and they fall in love with it, and then, for instance, there's no video, you know, radio doesn't like playing artists that don't have a video or a record company that's not willing to spend $100,000 to make a video. There has to be a whole package. You know, it can't just be a great song.
Certainly there are those instrumentals that have gained a second life as cannibalized clips and commercials or as samples on hip-hop records. But to hear anything new in the instrumental vein, or even well-remembered tunes like Telstar, you may well need to look beyond radio and follow the lead of high-tech teenagers.
The teenagers in America are not wed to their radios. They're wed to their MP3s, and they're wed to their computers, and they love their CDs. They're not turning on the radio to hear, you know, great new music first.
And for the digitally disinclined who hope and pray for the return to radio of more rock and soul without all the verbiage, the wait continues. In New York, for On the Media, I'm Rex Doan.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan and Jamie York. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Natasha Kurganker. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Beidel Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink. Drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.